Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Lisa S. Gardner. She's a science writer, geoscientist, and educator. And we're continuing our conversation about her book, Reefs of Time: What Fossils Reveal About Coral Survival. Lisa, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me, and I'm glad we get to talk more about it.
Well, in our first conversation, we talked about, you know, the prehistoric corals and then the very serious plight of contemporary corals.
Right.
As a matter of fact, there was a news article in a science journal, I can't remember, just this last week, saying we're approaching a tipping point for corals.
Yes. I'd love to talk more about that, too. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about your book first.
The
amazing thing about your book is it goes along we talk about the plight of, you write about the plight of corals, and it's looking very grim and dark.
Yeah.
And then as all of a sudden, I think it's chapter six, when reefs persist, all of a sudden it's the whole story of what we're trying to do to save reefs. And I love the way this book is sort of structured, because you're sort of down in the dumps about, oh God, everything's just falling apart. There's no hope. And then all of a sudden, there's hope.
I spent a lot of time thinking about this surface that between two layers of fossil reef in a fossil reef in the Bahamas. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that, because these are fossil reefs. They formed well before we were causing all these dramatic changes to the environment and warming climate and all that. But there was a time when the reef in that area died, and then somewhere between 100 and 1,000 years later or something like that, another reef grew. And of course, it's different. It's not the same situation as what we're facing today. But if we'd been alive at that time, yeah, we may have had the same grim reality of dying reefs that we're facing now, even if it's for very different reasons, and in this case, very much human-caused reasons. But thinking about that, you know, our perception of time and how we experience the world day to day, but then when we look into the fossil record, we're seeing sort of, you know, a time lapse, basically. You know, it's all sped up, and we can see what happened, you know, 120,000 years ago, what happened 110,000 years ago. We can go through time at this much faster rate and see what the story was. And I see some hope there, because in these times when we were losing coral reefs because of sea level changes, during the Ice Age, most of the coral species, all but two as far as we know, remained extant. So that's the opposite of extinct. They did not, the species did not die off.
Are you saying all but two remained extant?
All but two species became extinct sometime in the last 80,000 years. But over the course of the Ice Age, for at least a couple hundred thousand years, in that time period, the same coral species kept coming back and rebuilding reefs. Even when, you know, the glaciers were growing and sea level fell dramatically and then rose dramatically. So there were these times when their environment changed, and yet the species could persist, which is pretty impressive.
And that's the whole point of this book, is that it's useful to study prehistoric corals because they've lived through a lot of climate change, especially during the periods of glaciation, and where the sea levels have dropped dramatically, yet they survived. So they could offer us clues to how to create more resilient corals.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the big problems today, which is a bit different than in the past, is the very high rate of climate warming.
That's right.
So heat is an incredibly dramatic problem in coral reefs today. And corals are facing all sorts of other problems too. And as I think we talked about last time, corals in the tropics and subtropics, it's corals that build most of the foundation of coral reefs. And so coral reefs are home to just an amazing amount of marine life. It's largely because these animals called corals are building these rocky skeletons that create a lot of habitat on the seafloor. And so it's estimated that at least a quarter of all marine life relies on coral reefs for habitat, even though those areas are a very tiny percentage of the ocean. They're not all over the place, but they're just these biodiversity epicenters. And so keeping corals alive means that, we're in a better place to keep reefs healthier. And so that's one of the reasons in the book really focuses on corals. Even though coral reefs are a huge number of species of all sorts of different life, from sharks to turtles to, microbes to, and then corals, which are these invertebrate animals that are colonial for the most part and grow these huge skeletons. But it's those little invertebrates that create all this habitat. And so if they're vulnerable to heat, then everything else is at risk too.
What I love about this part, this last half of the book, is you go out and you spend time or you review the research of a lot of different people who are studying corals. So I want to talk about some of them. Can we talk about the research of Lauren Toth and the idea of marginal reefs?
Yes. Yeah. Now, Lauren Toth, she's, I believe, still with the U.S. Geological Survey. I hope so. Anyway, and she never can tell today.
That's right.
But she is studying sort of long-term patterns of change in coral reefs. And she's made a point to focus on coral reefs that are in the subtropics. So we usually think of coral reefs as being fully in the tropics, but she has looked at coral reefs in Florida in Florida, it's a subtropical environment. So they still get winter storms sometimes. We hear about it when it kills all the oranges and things like that. So these are environments that are not fully tropical. And then she's also studied the coral reefs in the eastern tropical Pacific, which this is off the west coast of Central America. And those eastern tropical Pacific reefs, that's also a hard place to be a coral. And so if you study the places where it's harder to be a coral, you can figure out sort of what they can endure and when they can't endure it any longer. And so that's an interesting way to look at coral reefs, to see, what can they withstand instead of trying to find the perfect conditions.
Are these marginal reefs considerably smaller than the large classic reefs found down in the tropics?
I don't think, not necessarily,
okay.
I should say, that they can be patchy. There are lots of areas in those marginal areas that where reefs are kind of a patchwork of areas where corals are more able to grow and areas where they're not. But there's also, until the 1970s, the reefs off the Florida Keys were enormous. And so, there's also these marginal reefs that are quite expansive. And so it really depends on the location.
Let's talk about refugia.
Yes.
In the last glacial period.
One of my favorite concepts.
Well, I'm familiar with the idea of refugia for terrestrial plants and animals, mm-hmm. because that happened during the last glacial period. There were these like islands that didn't get covered by the glaciers, and then certain species survived in that after mm-hmm. the glaciers retreated. But what happens with corals? Are there coral refugia?
So there are, and it's hard to study refugia in the fossil record because, by definition, a refugia is a small space where species are surviving in difficult times.
So it's exactly the same when we talk about terrestrial refugia.
Yes, exactly. And, in the in terrestrial refugia that are in the modern world, there's a big search for those, as climate is warming. And, for instance, the northern face of mountains might not get quite as hot, those sorts of things.
Yep.
You can, go out and find them in the world today, but in the fossil record, they become pretty much needles in haystacks that, how are you going to find a tiny place where species somehow survived? But in terms of coral reefs, because we haven't lost coral species except for two over, several hundred thousand years, those species must have survived somewhere, even if we don't have the coral reefs. We can't find the fossil reefs that they lived in. And it's also possible that they didn't build reefs, that the species were sort of hiding out in small areas where they were less vulnerable, but they weren't building a lot of limestone that became a huge habitat. And so there's also ways to look at genetics to see how animals survived in refugia. For instance, there's a study from the Great Barrier Reef that looked at the relatedness of a certain coral species, so individuals of that species in the Great Barrier Reef, and found that quite a long time ago, there were two very distinct populations of that species. So they were probably surviving in two different refugia that weren't, cross-pollinating, really, use a non-animal term, but that weren't breeding together, for quite some time. And so they're still the same species, but they sort of diverge genetically.
Is it possible that humans could build refugia?
So that's one thing that I explored in the book, and that there's all these efforts right now to restore coral reefs, which often means to create new coral colonies and essentially plant them into the seafloor to build the human-built coral reef. And I visit one of those in the book, which was just fascinating because it was really thriving when I saw it. And the idea of these sort of human-built reefs is in a lot of areas to bring coral cover back to coral reefs that have lost it. But if you do this in an area where water temperatures are less likely to overheat, so for instance, right, places where cool water gets mixed in with hot water, so it's less likely to have a marine heat wave, then that could be a refugia. You could be basically, giving those species a place to live that is a little less vulnerable. And so that's what I call a human-built refugia that, have ways of helping this. And people who are doing this reef restoration often focus on species, coral species and types of corals that are less affected by heat, that are more adapted for dealing with heat, so that the corals themselves are more resilient too.
What was fascinating to read, and this was funny to me, these people who are creating these refugia artificial coral reefs, they're building them themselves. So you have to ask yourself, well, a coral reef is not just the corals, it's a whole ecosystem. So what about the fish and the invertebrates? And I think you wrote, they found out that they just show up.
And I mean,
that just seems weird to me. So, like, where were they before?
I know. It's quite impressive. I think one thing to remember is that a lot of marine life reproduce through larvae. And so they're spreading their larvae in the plankton. So it's floating around in the ocean water. And so that allows even non-fish, like lobsters and things like that, to travel huge distances,
And they finally hook up with a refugia reef and bang.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And there's even some evidence that corals, when they are larvae, floating around in the ocean water, they seem to have the ability to sense where there's a coral reef.
Wow.
That they have the, you know, they tend to settle down in areas where there's a lot of other reef activity instead of, you know, other spots that are less animated with a lot of different biodiversity. And researchers are still figuring out why that is, but they think one reason is sound.
When I read this, this was totally weird. So that they can play the sounds of fish that you would normally find at a coral reef, and that attracts them.
Yeah, so fish, a lot of fish make noises, and shrimp and things like that at coral reefs.
Yeah.
A coral reef can be a pretty noisy place. There's a lot of crunching going on as animals eat, and there's, you know, other sorts of sounds that animals make too in a coral reef. But basically, it sounds like for at least some corals, they respond to that sound. They want to be in the most active place where there's the most going on.
That's wild.
And, you know, that would signify the healthiest coral reef. And so that's, you know, that's very new research, and we're still learning a lot more about it. But it's fascinating.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Lisa S. Gardner. She's a science writer, geoscientist, educator, and we're continuing our conversation about her book, Reefs of Time, What Fossils Reveal About Coral Survival. There's so many different things that people are trying to do that you review in this book. One of them is using mists of seawater to cool the reefs from above.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is that showing any promise?
It is. It is. I mean, I believe it's still in this testing phase. So, you know, anytime you basically geoengineer the planet, it takes a lot of a lot of effort to make sure that you're not causing another problem. And so I appreciate the fact that it's going slowly. I think that there's been about 5 years of testing, but we'll see, you know, how that progresses. But basically, what researchers, these experiments are going on in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's coast, and they are basically using something that's kind of like a snowmaking machine to vaporize seawater, so sending mists of seawater into the air, and the salt crystals become the nucleus of little tiny water droplets in the air. So this is how raindrops form, basically, is around some sort of particle, a piece of pollen, air pollution, dust, all sorts of things. But in this case, they're using the salt from seawater because it's on the ocean. And so if we can create basically clouds to shade the reef, does that then lower the temperature of the water, prevent some of the worst coral bleaching? And one criticism of this method is it's going to take a huge amount of effort. It would have to be done.
It's also going to take a huge amount of energy. It's going to take a huge amount of energy.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. You need boats out there. You need the cannon things that are sending the vapor.
You're also sucking up a lot of invertebrates while you're doing the water, right?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
I want to talk about more stuff because I'd like to cover more of the book. One of the things that people are obviously searching for are heat-tolerant species of corals.
Yes.
You talked about corals in the Red Sea. Corals adapt to what is essentially a very warm environment? And there's corals in the Gulf of Aqaba, which people have termed super corals for that reason, that they're very heat tolerant.
Right. It's a really interesting bit of prehistory that, last time glaciers were large, there's a mile deep of ice where you live. There's a lot of water on land, basically, so sea level was much lower. And at that time, the Red Sea got cut off. So this was about 20,000 years ago. The Red Sea got cut off from the rest of the ocean, from the Indian Ocean, and the water, dried up that was in there. It was no longer kind of, filtering in and out of the larger ocean. But then about, I think it was about 12,000 years ago, or maybe a little less, the sea levels rising and the strait going from the Indian Ocean into the Red Sea flooded, and so it was full of water again, and that those coral larvae came in with the water. But it was very, very warm in the southern part of the Red Sea, still is. And so corals adapted to that amount of heat and slowly over many generations migrated, or the larvae, you know, migrated with each generation further north in the Red Sea. And so the Gulf of Aqaba is at the northern end of the Red Sea and far northern end. So it's much further from the equator. It's not as hot in those waters, but the corals that went through that path up through the entire Red Sea had to adapt to much hotter temperatures, and they retained that adaptation. And so this is of course, it took thousands of years and many generations of corals for this type of evolution to happen. But they rarely bleach now. And so just like everywhere in the ocean, temperatures in the Gulf of Aqaba, water temperatures overheat sometimes. But those corals rarely bleach, and it's sort of an interesting place because of that. But unfortunately, around the world, you know, there aren't that many places where corals have been through that process. But there are some others where, for instance, where corals are overheated every time there's a low tide. So at low tide, they're in much shallower water. They're getting much hotter. And then, 6 hours later, 12 hours later, the tide comes in and they are cooled down again. So this is kind of like cross training for corals. They they get used to the heat in these small doses during each low tide. And those corals also seem to have this ability to deal with more heat than other corals. And in that case, there's probably an evolutionary component. About half of it, I believe, is evolution, adaptation by evolution.
But that's over thousands of years. And the problem is, as you write about, obviously, in the book, is that global climate change is happening really relatively quickly. Are there people trying to genetically alter corals so that they become more acclimatized?
There are efforts to do that. There's also another way that corals change over time is acclimation. So this is kind of like the same process if you plant a garden when you need to put your plants outside for short amounts of time in the spring to get them used to the temperature out there. So that's hardening is called for plants. Corals seem to have some of the same processes. And so that can happen not by evolution over many generations, but within, one individual change over time, getting used to the heat. And so some corals seem to be able to do that, to, at least half of their ability to tolerate heat seems to come from this getting used to it, hardening kind of process. And so that could potentially be a faster process since it doesn't take evolutionary timescales. But then there's also researchers moving genes from these very heat-tolerant corals into less heat-tolerant corals to see, can we improve the heat tolerance of some? And that's all very cutting edge, still work in progress.
We're almost out of time. We only have like 2 minutes left. But how do you feel about the future of reefs? And honestly,
I mean, it's depressing. I think we're going to see decades coming up where we're going to see lots of reefs lost. And
lost forever, do you think they could regenerate?
Well, that's the thing. Lost on most of our human timescales. If we are seeing ourselves as contributing to a conservation project that will be finished in 100 years or 300 years or more, then, there's a purpose to keeping as many species alive as we can, keeping them persisting until we get climate change under control, stop the rapid rate of warming. And it's taking a very long time to stop warming from happening so quickly, as we all know. But if we can, the more we can save what we can, the more possible it'll be for reefs to rebuild in the future. Maybe not with all the species we have today, but I believe it'll happen. I don't think I'll see it, but I believe it'll happen.
I think that's the thing that humans find hard to get on board with, a project that they're not going to see the results of.
Yes.
And that's like a story for another interview. I think that's the resistance to dealing with climate change. But we'll have that conversation later at some other point in time. My returning guest tonight is Lisa S. Gardner. She's a science writer, geoscientist, and educator. And we're continuing our conversation about her book. It's really a wonderful book about a very specific problem. Reefs of Time. What Fossils Reveal About Coral Survival. Lisa, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to talk to you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.